We'll certainly try, if your mother will let you. We drifted into the sitting room and sat down. Mother's voice called from the kitchen. Children, you let him alone. They're all right, Ollie, he called back. We sat in a triangle in the living room. Tom's face was so dark and his eyes so blue. He wore good clothes, but he never seemed well-dressed. In this, he was very different from his father. His red mustache was never neat, and his hair wouldn't lie down, and his hands were hard from work. Mary said, Uncle Tom, how do you get to be a boy? How? Why, Mary, you're just born a boy. No, that's not what I mean. How do I get to be a boy? Tom studied her gravely. You? He asked. Her words poured out. I don't want to be a girl, Uncle Tom. I want to be a boy. A girl's all kissing and dolls. I don't want to be a girl. I don't want to. Tears of anger welled up in Mary's eyes. Tom looked down at his hands and picked at a loose piece of callus with a broken nail. He wanted to say something beautiful, I think. He wished for words like his father's words, sweet-winged words, cooing and lovely. I wouldn't like you to be a boy, he said. Why not? I like you as a girl. An idol was crashing in Mary's temple. You mean you like girls? Yes, Mary. I like girls very much. A look of distaste crossed Mary's face. If it were true, Tom was a fool. She put on her don't give me any of that crap tone. All right, she said, but how do I go about being a boy? Tom had a good ear. He knew he was reeling down in Mary's estimation, and he wanted her to love him and to admire him. At the same time, there was a fine steel wire of truthfulness in him that cut off the heads of fast-traveling lies. He looked at Mary's hair, so light that it was almost white, and braided tight to be out of the way, and dirty at the end of the braid, for Mary wiped her hands on her braid before she made a difficult marble shot. Tom studied her cold and hostile eyes. I don't think you really want to change.
I do.
Tom was wrong. She really did. Well, he said, you can't. And someday you'll be glad.
I won't be glad, said Mary,
and she turned to me and said with frigid contempt,
he doesn't know.
Tom winced, and I shivered at the immensity of her criminal charge. Mary was braver and more ruthless than most. That's why she won every marble in Salinas. Tom said uneasily, if your mother says it's all right, I'll order the oyster loaf this morning and pick it up tonight.
I don't like oyster loaves,
said Mary, and stalked to our bedroom and slammed the door. Tom looked ruefully after her.
She's a girl, all right, he said.
Now we were alone together, and I felt that I had to heal the wound Mary had made.
I love oyster loaves, I said.
Sure you do. So does Mary.
Uncle Tom, don't you think there's some way for her to be a boy?
No, I don't, he said sadly. I would have told her if I had known.
She's the best pitcher in the West End.
Tom sighed and looked down at his hands again, and I could see his failure on him, and I was sorry for him, aching sorry. I brought out my hollowed cork with pins stuck down to make bars.
Would you like to have my fly cage, Uncle Tom?
Oh, he was a great gentleman.
Do you want me to have it?
Yes. You see, you pull up a pin to get the fly in, and then he sits in there and buzzes.
I'd like to have it very much. Thank you, John.
He worked all day with a sharp, tiny pocket knife on a small block of wood, and when we came home from school, he had carved a little face. The eyes and ears and lips were movable, and little perches connected them with the inside of the hollow head. At the bottom of the neck there was a hole closed by a cork, and this was very wonderful. You caught a fly and eased him through the hole and set the cork, and suddenly the head became alive. The eyes moved and the lips talked and the ears wiggled as the frantic fly crawled over the little perches. Even Mary forgave him a little, but she never really trusted him until after she was glad she was a girl, and then it was too late. He gave the head not to me, but to us. We still have it put away somewhere, and it still works. Sometimes Tom took me fishing. We started before the sun came up and drove in the rig straight toward Fremont's Peak, and as we neared the mountains, the stars would pale out and the light would rise to blacken the mountains. I can remember riding and pressing my ear and cheek against Tom's coat, and I can remember that his arm would rest lightly over my shoulders and his hand pat my arm occasionally. Finally, we would pull up under an oak tree and take the horse out of the shafts, water him at the stream side, and halter him to the back of the rig. I don't remember that Tom talked. Now that I think of it, I can't remember the sound of his voice or the kind of words he used. I can remember both about my grandfather, but when I think of Tom, it's a memory of a kind of warm silence. Maybe he didn't talk at all. Tom had beautiful tackle and made his own flies, but he didn't seem to care whether we caught trout or not. He needed not to triumph over animals. I remember the five-fingered ferns growing under little waterfalls, bobbing their green fingers as the droplets struck them. And I remember the smells of the hills, wild azalea and a very distant skunk, and the sweet cloy of lupin and horse sweat on harness. I remember the sweeping, lovely dance of high buzzards against the sky, and Tom looking long up at them. But I can't remember that he ever said anything about them. I remember holding the bite of a line while Tom drove pegs and braided a splice. I remember the smell of crushed ferns in the creel and the delicate sweet odor of fresh, damp rainbow trout lying so prettily on the green bed. And finally, I can remember coming back to the rig and pouring rolled barley into the leather feed bag and buckling it over the horse's head behind the ears. And I have no sound of his voice or words in my ear. He is dark and silent and hugely warm in my memory. Tom felt his darkness. His father was beautiful and clever. His mother was short and mathematically sure. Each of his brothers and sisters had looks or gifts or fortune. Tom loved all of them passionately, but he felt heavy and earthbound. He climbed ecstatic mountains and floundered in the rocky darkness between the peaks. He had spurts of bravery, but they were bracketed in battens of cowardice. Samuel said that Tom was quavering over greatness, trying to decide whether he could take the cold responsibility. Samuel knew his son's quality and felt the potential of violence, and it frightened him, for Samuel had no violence. Even when he hit Adam Trask with his fist, he had no violence. And the books that came into the house, some of them secretly, well, Samuel rode lightly on top of a book, and he balanced happily among ideas the way a man rides white rapids in a canoe. But Tom got into a book, crawled and groveled between the covers, tunneled like a mole among the thoughts, and came up with the book all over his face and hands. Violence and shyness. Tom's loins needed women, and at the same time, he didn't think himself worthy of a woman. For long periods, he would welter in a howling celibacy, and then he would take a train to San Francisco and roll and wallow in women. And then he would come back silently to the ranch, feeling weak and unfulfilled and unworthy. And he would punish himself with work, would plow and plant unprofitable land, would cut tough oak wood until his back was breaking and his arms were weary rags. It is probable that his father stood between Tom and the sun, and Samuel's shadow fell on him. Tom wrote secret poetry, and in those days it was only sensible to keep it secret. The poets were pale emasculates, and Western men held them in contempt. Poetry was a symptom of weakness, of degeneracy and decay. To read it was to court catcalls. To write it was to be suspected and ostracized. Poetry was a secret vice, and properly so. No one knows whether Tom's poetry was any good or not, for he showed it to only one person, and before he died, he burned every word. From the ashes on the stove, there must have been a great deal of it. Of all his family, Tom loved Desi best. She was gay. Laughter lived on her doorstep. Her shop was a unique institution in Salinas. It was a woman's world. Here, all the rules and the fears that created the iron rules went down. The door was closed to men. It was a sanctuary where women could be themselves, smelly, wanton, mystic, conceited, truthful, and interested. The whalebone corsets came off at Desi's, the sacred corsets that molded and warped woman flesh into goddess flesh. At Desi's, they were women who went to the toilet and overate and scratched and farted. And from this freedom came laughter, roars of laughter. Men could hear the laughter through the closed door and were properly frightened at what was going on, feeling perhaps that they were the butt of the laughter, which to a large extent was true. I can see Desi now, her gold pince-nez wobbling on a nose not properly bridged for pince-nez, her eyes streaming with hilarious tears, and her whole front constricted with muscular spasms of laughter. Her hair would come down and drift between her glasses and her eyes, and the glasses would fall off her wet nose and spin and swing at the end of their black ribbon. You had to order a dress from Desi months in advance, and you made 20 visits to her shop before you chose material and pattern. Nothing so healthy as Desi had ever happened to Salinas. The men had their lodges, their clubs, their whorehouses. The women, nothing but the altar guild and the mincing coquetry of the minister, until Desi came along. And then Desi fell in love. I don't know any details of her love affair, who the man was or what the circumstances, whether it was religion or a living wife, a disease or a selfishness. I guess my mother knew, but it was one of those things put away in the family closet and never brought out. And if other people in Salinas knew, they must have kept it a loyal town secret. All I do know is that it was a hopeless thing, gray and terrible. After a year of it, the joy was all drained out of Desi, and the laughter had ceased. Tom raged crazily through the hills like a lion in horrible pain. In the middle of a night, he saddled and rode away, not waiting for the morning train, to Salinas. Samuel followed him and sent a telegram from King City to Salinas. And when, in the morning, Tom, his face black, spurred his spent horse up John Street in Salinas, the sheriff was waiting for him. He disarmed Tom and put him in a cell and fed him black coffee and brandy until Samuel came for him. Samuel didn't lecture Tom. He took him home and never mentioned the incident. And a stillness fell on the Hamilton place. On Thanksgiving of 1911, the family gathered at the ranch, all the children except Joe, who was in New York, and Lizzie, who had left the family and joined another, and Una, who was dead. They arrived with presents and more food than even this clan could eat. They were all married, save Desi and Tom. Their children filled the Hamilton place with riot. The home place flared up, noisier than it had ever been. The children cried and screamed and fought. The men made many trips to the forge and came back self-consciously wiping their mustaches. Liza's little round face grew redder and redder. She organized and ordered. The kitchen stove never went out. The beds were full, and comforters laid on pillows on the floor were for children. Samuel dug up his old gaiety. His sardonic mind glowed, and his speech took on its old singing rhythm. He hung on with the talk and the singing and the memories, and then suddenly, and it not midnight, he tired. Weariness came down on him, and he went to his bed, where Liza had been for 2 hours. He was puzzled at himself. Not that he had to go to bed, but that he wanted to. When the mother and father were gone, Will brought the whiskey in from the forge, and the clan had a meeting in the kitchen with whiskey passed around in round-bottomed jelly glasses. The mothers crept to the bedrooms to see that the children were covered, and then came back. They all spoke softly, not to disturb the children and the old people. There were Tom and Desi, George and his pretty Mamie, who had been a Dempsey, Molly and William J. Martin, Olive and Ernest Steinbeck, Will and his Delia. They all wanted to say the same thing, all 10 of them. Samuel was an old man. It was as startling a discovery as the sudden seeing of a ghost. Somehow they hadn't believed it could happen. They drank their whiskey and talked softly of the new thought. His shoulders, did you see how they slump? And there's no spring in his step. His toes drag a little, but it's not that, it's in his eyes. His eyes are old. He never would go to bed until last. Did you notice he forgot what he was saying right in the middle of a story? It's his skin, told me. It's gone wrinkled, and the backs of his hands have turned transparent. He favors his right leg. Yes, but that's the one the horse broke. I know, but he never favored it before. They said these things in outrage. This can't happen, they were saying. Father can't be an old man. Samuel is young as the dawn, the perpetual dawn. He might get old as midday, maybe, but sweet God, the evening cannot come. And the night, sweet God, no. It was natural that their minds leaped on and recoiled. And they wouldn't speak of that, but their minds said, there can't be any world without Samuel. How could we think about anything without knowing what he thought about it? What would the spring be like, or Christmas, or rain? There couldn't be a Christmas. Their minds shrank away from such thinking, and they looked for a victim, someone to hurt because they were hurt. They turned on Tom. You were here. You've been here all along. How did this happen? When did it happen? Who did this to him? Have you by any chance done this with your craziness? And Tom could stand it because he had been with it. It was Una, he said hoarsely. He couldn't get over Una. He told me how a man, a real man, has no right to let sorrow destroy him. He told me again and again how I must believe that time would take care of it. He said it so often that I knew he was losing. Why didn't you tell us? Maybe we could have done something. Tom leaped up, violent and cringing. God damn it! What was there to tell? That he was dying of sorrow? That the marrow had melted out of his bones? What was there to tell? You weren't here. I had to look at it and see his eyes die down, God damn it! Tom went out of the room and they heard his clodhopper feet knocking on the flinty ground outside. They were ashamed. Will Martin said, I'll go out and bring him back. Don't do it, George said quickly, and the blood kin nodded. Don't do it. Let him alone. We know him from the insides of ourselves. In a little while, Tom came back. I want to apologize, he said. I'm very sorry. Maybe I'm a little drunk. Father calls it jolly when I do it. One night, I rode home. It was a confession. And I came staggering across the yard, and I fell into the rose bush and crawled up the stairs on my hands and knees, and I was sick on the floor beside my bed. In the morning, I tried to tell him I was sorry. Do you know what he said? Why, Tom, you were just jolly. Jolly if I did it. A drunken man didn't crawl home, just jolly. George stopped the crazy flow of talk. We want to apologize to you, Tom, he said. Why, we sounded as though we were blaming you, and we didn't mean to. Or maybe we did mean to, and were sorry. Will Martin said realistically, it's too hard a life here. Why don't we get him to sell out and move to town? He could have a long and happy life. Molly and I would like him to come down and live with us. I don't think he'd do it, said Will. He's stubborn as a mule and proud as a horse. He's got a pride like brass. Olive's husband, Ernest, said, Well, there'd be no harm in asking him. We would like to have him, or both of them, with us. Then they were silent again, for the idea of not having the ranch, the dry, stony desert of heartbreaking hillside and unprofitable hollow, was shocking to them. Will Hamilton, from instinct and training in business, had become a fine reader of the less profound impulses of men and women. He said, If we ask him to close up shop It'll be like asking him to close his life, and he won't do it. You're right, Will, George agreed. He'd think it was like quitting. He'd feel it was a cowardice. No, he'll never sell out. And if he did, I don't think he would live a week. Will said, there's another way. Maybe he could come for a visit. Tom can run the ranch. It's time Father and Mother saw something of the world. All kinds of things are happening. It would freshen him. And then he could come back and go to work again. And after a while, maybe he wouldn't have to. He says himself that thing about time doing the job dynamite can't touch. Desi brushed the hair out of her eyes. I wonder if you really think he's that stupid, she said. And Will said out of his experience, sometimes a man wants to be stupid if it lets him do a thing his cleverness forbids. We can try it anyway. What do you all think? There was a nodding of heads in the kitchen, and only Tom sat rock-like and brooding. Tom, wouldn't you be willing to take over the ranch? George asked. Oh, that's nothing, said Tom. It's no trouble to run the ranch because the ranch doesn't run, never has. Then why don't you agree? I'd find a reluctance to insult my father, Tom said. He'd know. But where's the harm in suggesting it? Tom rubbed his ears until he forced the blood out of them, and for a moment they were white. I don't forbid you, he said, but I can't do it. George said, we could write it in a letter, a kind of invitation full of jokes. And when he got tired of one of us, why, he could go to another. There's years of visiting among the lot of us. And that was how they left it. Tom brought Olive's letter from King City, and because he knew what it contained, he waited until he caught Samuel alone before he gave it to him. Samuel was working in the forge, and his hands were black. He took the envelope by a tiny corner and put it on the anvil, and then he scrubbed his hands in the half barrel of black water into which he plunged hot iron. He slit the letter open with the point of a horseshoe nail and went into the sunlight to read it. Tom had the wheels off the buckboard and was buttering the axles with yellow axle grease. He watched his father from the corners of his eyes. Samuel finished the letter and folded it and put it back in its envelope. He sat on the bench in front of the shop and stared into space. Then he opened the letter and read it again and folded it again and put it in his blue shirt pocket. Then Tom saw him stand up and walk slowly up the eastern hill, kicking at the flints on the ground. There had been a little rain, and a fuzz of miserly grass had started up. Halfway up the hill, Samuel squatted down and took up a handful of the harsh, gravelly earth in his palm and spread it with his forefinger, flint and sandstone and bits of shining mica and a frail rootlet and a veined stone. He let it slip from his hand and brushed his palms. He picked a spear of grass and set it between his teeth and stared up the hill to the sky. A gray, nervous cloud was scurrying eastward, searching for trees on which to rain. Samuel stood up and sauntered down the hill. He looked into the tool shed and patted the 4x4 supports. He paused near Tom and spun one of the free-running wheels of the buckboard, and he inspected Tom as though he saw him for the first time. Why, you're a grown-up man, he said. Didn't you know? I guess I did, said Samuel, and sauntered on. There was the sardonic look on his face his family knew so well, the joke on himself that made him laugh inwardly. He walked by the sad little garden and all around the house, not a new house anymore. Even the last added lean-to bedrooms were old and weathered, and the putty around the window panes had shrunk away from the glass. At the porch he turned and surveyed the whole home cup of the ranch before he went inside. Liza was rolling out pie crust on the floury board. She was so expert with the rolling pin that the dough seemed alive. It flattened out and then pulled back a little from the tension in itself. Liza lifted the pale sheet of it and laid it over one of the pie tins and trimmed the edges with a knife. The prepared berries lay deep in red juice in a bowl. Samuel sat down on a kitchen chair and crossed his legs and looked at her. His eyes were smiling.
"Can't you find something to do this time of day?" she asked.
"Oh, I guess I could, Mother, if I wanted to."
"Well, don't sit there and make me nervous. The paper's in the other room if you're feeling day-lazy."
"I've read it," said Samuel.
"All of it?"
"All I want to."
"Samuel, what's the matter with you? You're up to something. I can see it in your face. Now tell it and let me get on with my pies."
He swung his leg and smiled at her. "Such a little bit of a wife," he said. "Three of her is hardly a bite."
"Samuel, now you stop this. I don't mind a joke in the evening sometimes, but it's not 11 o'clock. Now you go along."
Samuel said, "Liza, do you know the meaning of the English word vacation?"
"Now don't you make jokes in the morning."
"Do you, Liza?"
"Of course I do. Don't play me for a fool."
"What does it mean?"
"Going away for a rest to the sea and the beach. Now, Samuel, get out with your fooling."
"I wonder how you know the word."
"Will you tell me what you're after? Why shouldn't I know?"
"Did you ever have one, Liza?"
"Why, I..."
She stopped. "In 50 years, did you ever have a vacation, you little, silly, half-pint smidgen of a wife?"
"Samuel, please go out of my kitchen," she said apprehensively. He took the letter from his pocket and unfolded it.
"It's from Ollie," he said. "She wants us to come and visit in Salinas. They fixed over the upstairs room. She wants us to get to know the children. She's got us tickets for the Chautauqua season. Billy Sunday's going to wrestle with the devil, and Brian is going to make his cross of gold speech. I'd like to hear that. It's an old fool of a speech, but they say he gives it in a way to break your heart."
Liza rubbed her nose and floured it with her finger. "Is it very costly?" she asked anxiously.
"Costly? Ollie has bought the tickets. They're a present."
"We can't go," said Liza. "Who'd run the ranch?"
"Tom would. What running there is to do in the winter."
"He'd be lonely."
"George would maybe come out and stay a while to go quail hunting." "See what's in the letter, Liza?"
"What are those?"
2 tickets to Salinas on the train. Ollie says she doesn't want to give us a single escape."
"You can just turn them in and send her back the money."
"No, I can't."
"Why, Liza. Mother. Now, don't. Here's a handkerchief." "That's a dish towel," said Liza. "Sit here, Mother. There. I guess the shock of taking a rest kind of threw you. Here, I know it's a dish towel. They say that Billy Sunday drives the devil all over the stage." "That's a blasphemy," said Liza. "But I'd like to see it, wouldn't you? What did you say? Hold up your head, I didn't hear you. What did you say?" "I said yes," said Liza.
Tom was making a drawing when Samuel came into him. Tom looked at his father with veiled eyes, trying to read the effect of Olive's letter. Samuel looked at the drawing.
"What is that?"
"I'm trying to work out a gate opener, so a man won't have to get out of his rig. Here's the pull rod to open the latch."
"What's going to open it?"
"I figured a strong spring."
Samuel studied the drawing. "Then what's going to close it?"
"This bar here. It would slip to this spring with the tension the other way."
"I see," said Samuel. "It might work, too, if the gate was truly hung. And it would only take twice as much time to make and keep up as 20 years of getting out of the rig and opening the gate."
Tom protested.
"Sometimes with a skittish horse..."
"I know," said his father. "But the main reason is that it's fun."
Tom grinned.
"Caught me," he said.
"Tom, do you think you could look after the ranch if your mother and I took a little trip?"
"Why, sure," said Tom. "Where do you plan to go?"
"Ollie wants us to stay with her for a while in Salinas."
"Why, that'd be fine," said Tom. "Is Mother agreeable?"
"She is,"
always forgetting the expense.
That's fine, said Tom. How long do you plan to be gone?
Samuel's jeweled, sardonic eyes dwelt on Tom's face until Tom said,
What's the matter, Father?
It's the little tone, son. So little that I could barely hear it, but it was there. Tom, my son, if you have a secret with your brothers and sisters, I don't mind. I think that's good.
I don't know what you mean, said Tom.
You may thank God you didn't want to be an actor, Tom, because you would have been a very bad one. You worked it out at Thanksgiving, I guess, when you were all together. And it's working smooth as butter. I see Will's hand in this. Don't tell me if you don't want to.
I wasn't in favor of it, said Tom.
It doesn't sound like you, his father said. You'd be scattering the truth out in the sun for me to see. Don't tell the others I know. He turned away and then came back and put his hand on Tom's shoulder. Thank you for wanting to honor me with the truth, my son. It's not clever, but it's more permanent.
I'm glad you're going.
Samuel stood in the doorway of the forge and looked at the land. They say a mother loves best an ugly child, he said, and he shook his head sharply. Tom, I'll trade you honor for honor. You will please hold this in your dark, secret place, nor tell any of your brothers and sisters. I know why I'm going. And Tom, I know where I'm going. And I am content.
Chapter 24. I have wondered why it is that some people are less affected and torn by the verities of life and death than others. Una's death cut the earth from under Samuel's feet and opened his defended keep and let in old age. On the other hand, Liza, who surely loved her family as deeply as did her husband, wasn't destroyed or warped. Her life continued evenly. She felt sorrow, but she survived it. I think perhaps Liza accepted the world as she accepted the Bible, with all of its paradoxes and its reverses. She didn't like death, but she knew it existed, and when it came, it didn't surprise her. Samuel may have thought and played and philosophized about death, but he didn't really believe in it. His world didn't have death as a member. He, and all around him, was immortal. When real death came, it was an outrage, a denial of the immortality he deeply felt, and the one crack in his wall caused the whole structure to crash. I think he had always thought he could argue himself out of death. It was a personal opponent, and one he could lick. To Liza, it was simply death, the thing promised and expected. She could go on and, in her sorrow, put a pot of beans in the oven, bake 6 pies, and plan to exactness how much food would be necessary properly to feed the funeral guests. And she could, in her sorrow, see that Samuel had a clean white shirt, and that his black broadcloth was brushed and free of spots, and his shoes blacked. Perhaps it takes these 2 kinds to make a good marriage, riveted with several kinds of strengths. Once Samuel accepted, he could probably go farther than Liza, but the process of accepting tore him to pieces. Liza watched him closely after the decision to go to Salinas. She didn't know quite what he was up to, but, like a good and cautious mother, she knew he was up to something. She was a complete realist. Everything else being equal, she was glad to be going to visit her children. She was curious about them and their children. She had no love of places. A place was only a resting stage on the way to heaven. She didn't like work for itself, but she did it because it was there to be done. And she was tired. Increasingly, it was more difficult to fight the aches and stiffnesses which tried to keep her in bed in the morning, not that they ever succeeded. And she looked forward to heaven, as a place where clothes didn't get dirty, and where food didn't have to be cooked and dishes washed. Privately, there were some things in heaven of which she did not quite approve. There was too much singing, and she didn't see how even the elect could survive very long the celestial laziness which was promised.
She would find something to do in heaven. There must be something to take up one's time, some clouds to darn, some weary wings to rub with liniment. Maybe the collars of the robes needed turning now and then. And when you come right down to it, she couldn't believe that even in heaven there wouldn't be cobwebs in some corner to be knocked down with a cloth-covered broom. She was gay and frightened about the visit to Salinas. She liked the idea so well that she felt there must be something bordering on sin involved in it. And the Chautauqua? Well, she didn't have to go and probably wouldn't. Samuel would run wild. She would have to watch him. She never lost her feeling that he was young and helpless. It was a good thing that she didn't know what went on in his mind, and through his mind, what happened to his body. Places were very important to Samuel. The ranch was a relative, and when he left it, he plunged a knife into a darling. But having made up his mind, Samuel set about doing it well. He made formal calls on all of his neighbors, the old-timers who remembered how it used to be and how it was. And when he drove away from his old friends, they knew they wouldn't see him again, although he didn't say it. He took to gazing at the mountains and the trees, even at faces, as though to memorize them for eternity. He saved his visit to the Trask place for last. He hadn't been there for months. Adam wasn't a young man anymore. The boys were 11 years old, and Lee didn't change much. Lee walked to the shed with Samuel. "I've wanted to talk to you for a long time," said Lee, "but there's so much to do, and I try to get to San Francisco at least once a month."
"You know how it is," Samuel said. "When you know a friend is there, you don't go to see him. Then he's gone, and you blast your conscience to shreds that you didn't see him."
"I heard about your daughter. I'm sorry."
"I got your letter, Lee. I have it. You said good things."
"Chinese things," said Lee. "I seem to get more Chinese as I get older."
"There's something changed about you, Lee. What is it?"
"It's my cue, Mr. Hamilton. I've cut off my cue."
"That's it. We all did, haven't you heard?
The Dowager Empress is gone. China is free. The Manchus aren't overlords, and we don't wear cues. It was a proclamation of the new government. There's not a cue left anywhere."
"Does it make a difference, Lee?"
"Not much. It's easier. There's a kind of looseness on the scalp that makes me uneasy. It's hard to get used to the convenience of it."
"How's Adam?"
"He's all right, but he hasn't changed much. I wonder what he was like before."
"Yes, I've wondered about that. It was a short flowering. The boys must be big."
"They are big. I'm glad I stayed here. I learned a great deal from seeing the boys grow and helping a little."
"Did you teach them Chinese?"
"No. Mr. Trask didn't want me to. And I guess he was right. It would have been a needless complication. But I'm their friend. Yes, I'm their friend.
They admire their father, but I think they love me.
And they're very different. You can't imagine how different."
"In what way, Lee?"
"You'll see when they come home from school. They're like two sides of a medal. Cal is sharp and dark and watchful. And his brother, well, he's a boy you like before he speaks and like more afterwards."
"And you don't like Cal?"
"I find myself defending him, to myself. He's fighting for his life, and his brother doesn't have to fight."
"I have the same thing in my brood," said Samuel. "I don't understand it. You'd think with the same training and the same blood they'd be alike, but they're not at all." Later, Samuel and Adam walked down the oak-shadowed road to the entrance to the draw, where they could look out at the Salinas Valley.
"Will you stay to dinner?" Adam asked.
"I will not be responsible for the murder of more chickens," said Samuel.
"Lee's got a pot roast."
"Well, in that case..." Adam still carried one shoulder lower than the other from the old hurt. His face was hard and curtained, and his eyes looked at generalities and didn't inspect details. The two men stopped on the road and looked out at the valley, green-tinged from the early rains. Samuel said softly, I wonder you don't feel ashamed at leaving that land fallow.
I had no reason to plant it, Adam said. We had that out before. You thought I would change. I haven't changed.
Do you take pride in your hurt? Samuel asked. Does it make you seem large and tragic?
I don't know.
Well, think about it. Maybe you're playing a part on a great stage with only yourself as audience.
A slight anger came into Adam's voice. Why do you come to lecture me? I'm glad you come, but why do you dig into me?
To see whether I can raise a little anger in you. I'm a nosy man. But there's all that fallow land, and here beside me is all that fallow man. It seems a waste. And I have a bad feeling about waste because I could never afford it. Is it a good feeling to let your life lie fallow?
What else could I do?
You could try again.
Adam faced him. I'm afraid to, Samuel, he said. I'd rather just go about it this way. Maybe I haven't the energy or the courage.
How about your boys? Do you love them?
Yes. Yes.
Do you love one more than the other?
Why do you say that?
I don't know, something about your tone.
Let's go back to the house, said Adam.
They strolled back under the trees. Suddenly, Adam said,
Did you ever hear that Kathy was in Salinas? Did you ever hear such a rumor?
Did you?
Yes, but I don't believe it. I can't believe it.
Samuel walked silently in the sandy wheel rut of the road. His mind turned sluggishly in the pattern of Adam, and almost wearily took up a thought he had hoped was finished. He said at last,
You've never let her go.
I guess not. But I've let the shooting go. I don't think about it anymore.
I can't tell you how to live your life, Samuel said, although I do be telling you how to live it. I know that it might be better for you to come out from under your might-have-beens into the winds of the world. And while I tell you, I am myself sifting my memories, the way men pan the dirt under a barroom floor for the bits of gold dust that fall between the cracks. It's small mining, small mining. You're too young a man to be panning memories, Adam. You should be getting yourself some new ones, so that the mining will be richer when you come to age.
Adam's face was bent down, and his jawbone jutted below his temples from clenching. Samuel glanced at him.
That's right, he said. Set your teeth in it. How we do defend a wrongness. Shall I tell you what you do, so you will not think you invented it? When you go to bed and blow out the lamp, then she stands in the doorway with a little light behind her, and you can see her nightgown stir. And she comes sweetly to your bed, and you, hardly breathing, turn back the covers to receive her, and move your head over on the pillow to make room for her head beside yours. You can smell the sweetness of her skin, and it smells like no other skin in the world.
Stop it! Adam shouted at him. God damn you, stop it! Stop nosing over my life! You're like a coyote sniffing around a dead cow.
The way I know, Samuel said softly, is that one came to me that selfsame way, night after month after year, right to the very now. And I think I should have double-bolted my mind and sealed off my heart against her. But I did not. All of these years I've cheated Liza. I've given her an untruth, a counterfeit, and I've saved the best for those dark, sweet hours. And now I could wish that she may have had some secret caller, too, but I'll never know that. I think she would maybe have bolted her heart shut and thrown the key to hell.
Adam's hands were clenched, and the blood was driven out of his white knuckles.
You make me doubt myself, he said fiercely. You always have. I'm afraid of you. What should I do, Samuel? Tell me. I don't know how you saw the thing so clear. What should I do?
I know the shoulds, although I never do them, Adam. I always know the shoulds. You should try to find a new Kathy. You should let the new Kathy kill the dream Kathy. Let the two of them fight it out. And you, sitting by, should marry your mind to the winner. That's the second best should. The best would be to search out and find some fresh new loveliness to cancel out the old.
I'm afraid to try, said Adam.
That's what you've said. And now I'm going to put a selfishness on you. I'm going away, Adam. I came to say goodbye.
What do you mean?
My daughter Olive has asked Liza and me to visit with her in Salinas, and we're going. Day after tomorrow.
Well, you'll be back.
Samuel went on. After we've visited with Olive for maybe a month or two, there will come a letter from George. And his feelings will be hurt if we don't visit him in Paso Robles. And after that, Molly will want us in San Francisco. And then Will, and maybe even Joe in the East, if we should live so long.
Well, won't you like that? You've earned it. You've worked hard enough on that dust heap of yours.
I love that dust heap, Samuel said. I love it the way a bitch loves her runty pup. I love every flint, the plow-breaking outcroppings, the thin and barren topsoil, the waterless heart of her. Somewhere in my dust heap there is a richness.
You deserve a rest.
There, you said it again, said Samuel. That's what I had to accept, and I have accepted. When you say I deserve a rest, you are saying that my life is over.
Do you believe that?
That's what I have accepted. Adam said excitedly,
You can't do that. Why, if you accept that, you won't live.
I know, said Samuel.
But you can't do that.
Why not?
I don't want you to.
I'm a nosy old man, Adam. And the sad thing to me is that I'm losing my nosiness. That's maybe how I know it's time to visit my children. I'm having to pretend to be nosy a good deal of the time.
I'd rather you worked your guts out on your dust heap.
Samuel smiled at him. What a nice thing to hear, and I thank you. It's a good thing to be loved, even late. Suddenly, Adam turned in front of him so that Samuel had to stop.
I know what you've done for me, Adam said. I can't return anything. But I can ask you for one more thing. If I asked you, would you do me one more kindness and maybe save my life?
I would if I could. Adam swung out his hand and made an arc over the west.
That land out there. Would you help me make the garden we talked of? The windmills and the wells and the flats of alfalfa? We could raise flower seed. There's money in that. Think of what it would be like, acres of sweet peas and golden squares of calendulas. Maybe 10 acres of roses for the gardens of the west. Think how they'd smell on the west wind.
You're going to make me cry, Samuel said, and that would be an unseemly thing in an old man. And indeed his eyes were wet. I thank you, Adam, he said. The sweetness of your offer is a good smell in the west wind.
Then you'll do it?
No, I will not do it. But I'll see it in my mind when I'm in Salinas, listening to William Jennings Bryan. And maybe I'll get to believe it happened.
But I want to do it.
Go and see my Tom. He'll help you. He'd plant the world with roses, poor man, if he could.
You know what you're doing, Samuel?
Yes, I know what I'm doing. Know so well that it's half done.
What a stubborn man you are.
Contentious, said Samuel. Liza says I'm contentious, but now I'm caught in the web of my children. And I think I like it.
This ends Disc 11. East of Eden, Disc 12.
The dinner table was set in the house. Lee said,
I'd have liked to serve it under the tree like the other times, but the air is chilly.
So it is, Lee, said Samuel.
The twins came in silently and stood shyly staring at their guest.
It's a long time since I've seen you boys, but we named you well. You're Caleb, aren't you?
I'm Cal.
Well, Cal, then. And he turned to the other. Have you found a way to rip the backbone out of your name?
Sir?
Are you called Aaron?
Yes, sir.
Lee chuckled.
He spells it with one A. The two A's seem a little fancy to his friends. I've got 35 Belgian hares, sir, Aaron said. Would you like to see them, sir? The hutch is up by the spring. I've got 8 newborns, just born yesterday.
I'd like to see them, Aaron. His mouth twitched. Cal, don't tell me you're a gardener.
Lee's head snapped around and he inspected Samuel. Don't do that, Lee said nervously. Cal said, next year my father is going to let me have an acre in the flat. Aaron said, I got a buck rabbit weighs 15 pounds, and I'm going to give it to my father for his birthday.
They heard Adam's bedroom door opening.
Don't tell him, Adam said quickly. It's a secret.
Lee sawed at the pot roast.
Always you bring trouble for my mind, Mr. Hamilton, he said. Sit down, boys.
Adam came in, turning down his sleeves, and took his seat at the head of the table.
Good evening, boys, he said, and they replied in unison. Good evening, father.
And
don't you tell, said Aaron.
I won't, Samuel assured him.
Don't tell what? Adam asked.
Samuel said, can't there be a privacy? I have a secret with your son.
Cal broke in. I'll tell you a secret, too, right after dinner.
I'd like to hear it, said Samuel. And I do hope I don't know what it already is.
Lee looked up from his carving and glared at Samuel. He began piling meat on the plates. The boys ate quickly and quietly, wolfed their food. Aaron said, will you excuse us, father? Adam nodded, and the two boys went quickly out. Samuel looked after them.
They seem older than 11, he said. I seem to remember that at 11 my brood were howlers and screamers and runners in circles. These seem like grown men.
Do they? Adam asked. Lee said, I think I see why that is. There is no woman in the house to put a value on babies. I don't think men much care for babies, and so it was never an advantage to these boys to be babies. There was nothing to gain by it. I don't know whether that is good or bad.
Samuel wiped up the remains of gravy in his plate with a slice of bread. Adam, I wonder whether you know what you have in Lee. A philosopher who can cook or a cook who can think? He's taught me a great deal. You must have learned from him, Adam.
Adam said, I'm afraid I didn't listen enough. Or maybe he didn't talk.
Why didn't you want the boys to learn Chinese, Adam?
Adam thought for a moment. It seems a time for honesty, he said at last. I guess it was plain jealousy. I gave it another name, but maybe I didn't want them to be able so easily to go away from me in a direction I couldn't follow.
That's reasonable enough, and almost too human, said Samuel. But knowing it, that's a great jump. I wonder whether I have ever gone so far.
Lee brought the gray enameled coffee pot to the table and filled the cups and sat down. He warmed the palm of his hand against the rounded side of his cup. And then Lee laughed. You've given me great trouble, Mr. Hamilton, and you've disturbed the tranquility of China.
How do you mean, Lee?
It almost seems that I have told you this, said Lee. Maybe I only composed it in my mind, meaning to tell you. It's an amusing story, anyway.
I want to hear, said Samuel. And he looked at Adam. Don't you want to hear, Adam? Or are you slipping into your cloud bath?
I was thinking of that, said Adam. It's funny. A kind of excitement is coming over me.
That's good, said Samuel.
Maybe that's the best of all good things that can happen to a human. Let's hear your story, Lee.
The Chinese reached to the side of his neck and he smiled. I wonder whether I'll ever get used to the lack of a cue, he said. I guess I used it more than I knew. Yes, the story. I told you, Mr. Hamilton, that I was growing more Chinese. Do you ever grow more Irish?
It comes and goes, said Samuel.
Do you remember when you read to us the 16 verses of the 4th chapter of Genesis and we argued about them?
I do indeed. That's a long time ago.
10 years, nearly, said Lee. Well, the story bit deeply into me, and I went into it word for word. The more I thought about the story, the more profound it became to me. Then I compared the translations we have, and they were fairly close. There was only one place that bothered me. The King James Version says this. It is when Jehovah has asked Cain why he's angry. Jehovah says, "If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." And it was the thou shalt that struck me, because it was a promise that Cain would conquer sin.
Samuel nodded. And his children didn't do it entirely, he said.
Lee sipped his coffee. Then I got a copy of the American Standard Bible. It was very new then, and it was different in this passage. It says, "Do thou rule over him." Now this is very different. This is not a promise, it is an order. And I began to stew about it. I wondered what the original word of the original writer had been, that these very different translations could be made.
Samuel put his palms down on the table and leaned forward, and the old young light came into his eyes. Lee, he said, don't tell me you studied Hebrew.
Lee said, I'm going to tell you, and it's a fairly long story. Will you have a touch of incompi?
You mean the drink that tastes of good rotten apples?
Yes, I can talk better with it.
Maybe I can listen better, said Samuel. While Lee went to the kitchen, Samuel asked, Adam, did you know about this?
No, said Adam. He didn't tell me. Maybe I wasn't listening.
Lee came back with his stone bottle and three little porcelain cups, so thin and delicate that the light shone through them.
Blinky Chinese fashion, he said,
and poured the almost black liquor.
There's a lot of wormwood in this. It's quite a drink, he said. Has about the same effect as absinthe if you drink enough of it.
Samuel sipped the drink.
I want to know why you were so interested, he said.
Well, it seemed to me that the man who could conceive this great story would know exactly what he wanted to say, and there would be no confusion in his statement.
You say the man. Do you then not think this is a divine book written by the inky finger of God?
I think the mind that could think this story was a curiously divine mind. We have had a few such minds in China, too.
I just wanted to know, said Samuel. You're not a Presbyterian after all.
I told you I was getting more Chinese. Well, to go on. I went to San Francisco, to the headquarters of our family association. Do you know about them? Our great families have centers where any member can get help or give it. The Lee family is very large. It takes care of its own.
I have heard of them, said Samuel.
You mean Chinese hatchet men fighty tong war over slave girl?
I guess so.
It's a little different from that, really, said Lee. I went there because in our family there are a number of ancient reverend gentlemen who are great scholars. They are thinkers in exactness. A man may spend many years pondering a sentence of the scholar you call Confucius. I thought there might be experts in meaning who could advise me. They're fine old men. They smoke their two pipes of opium in the afternoon, and it rests and sharpens them. And they sit through the night, and their minds are wonderful. I guess no other people have been able to use opium well.
Lee dampened his tongue in the black brew. I respectfully submitted my problem to one of these sages, read him the story, and told him what I understood from it.